Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello, I'm Alan Saunders, and this is By Design. Today, we're hanging around in hotels and wondering what makes for a well-designed lobby. We're also hitting the streets, or at least the canals, of Venice to find out about the ideas behind that city's architecture biennale. And talking about innovative architecture, what about innovative engineering? Should we be afraid of it? The last time you visited your doctor, did you care about the design of the waiting and consultation rooms? Well, perhaps it troubled you that the greenery owed more to plastics technology than to horticulture, or that the magazines were full of the latest news about the Battle of El Alamein. But many patients and many doctors think that aesthetics take a back seat to the primary function of a medical clinic. But should they? The Royal Australian College of General Practitioners recently joined forces with RMIT University to look at the benefits of good design for GPs and their patients. The result is Rebirth of a Clinic, a design manual for architecture in general practice and primary care. And to talk about it, I'm joined in our Melbourne studio by Graham Crist, who practices architecture and teaches it at RMIT, and on the phone by Dr. Hoi Ahn, a Sydney GP and committee member of the General College of Practitioners, who collaborated with Graham on this project. Well, welcome to you both.
Thank Good you. Morning.
Welcome. Good morning.
Perhaps I might start with the receiving end of the process. Dr. Ahn, do you think patients have a fairly low expectation about the environment they'll find when they visit a doctor?
Good morning, Alan. Traditionally, I think this is the way people may think. But if you look at the trend, you know, on the side of the doctor, I can see that there are more and more doctors moving towards the, you know, a multidiscipline, one-stop shop, and purposely build medical centres. And on the other hand, I guess there are more patients conscious about the building itself. So I would say that that traditional thinking is changing. What do you think, Graham?
I think it is changing, and I think there's probably traditions of this interest in architecture through clinics that go way back, but there's also an expectation that the clinic might be an architecture-free zone, and so the expectations often are quite low. Nevertheless, I don't see really a disjunction between the aesthetics or design values and the functioning of the clinic.
Well, Graham, let's look at some specifics, starting with the entrance. Now, you'd imagine that a doctor's surgery would be the one place where you'd find good access for people with disabilities, but that's often not the case, is it?
That's right. I mean, that's true lots of public buildings that precede a certain date. There's a great tradition, of course, of GP clinics being converted from a house or another little building, and so there are an awful lot of clinics that are operating out of those sort of facilities. That's changing now. And so, in a way, they're probably no better or worse than other buildings, but certainly a lot where the access is not so good.
And one thing that you encounter in reception areas of medical clinics is a lot of sick people. Dr. Ahn, is cross-infection, both from patient to patient and from patients to staff, is that an issue which should be considered in design?
Absolutely, Alan, absolutely. Particularly in the standard of general practice, as a lot of general, if you can see that a lot of practice now are accredited, which means they have to meet certain standard. And one of the standard is to prevent the cross-infection both among patients and from patients' staff. And that's why design itself is a very important thing, right at the beginning, right at the lobby, at the waiting room of the surgery. I believe Graham has a lot of thought into it too.
Well, I want to know how design can help here. I mean, short of actually giving every patient their own waiting room, what can you do?
There's a lot. There's a lot to the design. You can talk about, you can think about the design in terms of the time and the design in terms of space. In terms of timing, say, when the patients are more at risk of infected other patients or the staff, obviously the scheduling of the patient will reduce the waiting time of the patient. We move the patient faster from one area to another to avoid the contact with other patients. In terms of space, I believe that Graham can elaborate more on that. You can put the patients on a different area to reduce the infection risk.
So, Graham, lots
of these questions really are to do with how we might think about primary care and thinking about a GP's clinic is not really a hospital. Although there are sick people there, there are lots of people who are quite well. We saw some interesting examples, a clinic in Perth, for example, where the doctors were scheduling appointments depending on whether the patient was acute or just coming in for a general checkup and so on. So there were two spaces that were joined but in a way separate so that you could come to the doctor for different reasons, and so that was kind of mapped out spatially in the clinic. Others where they thought the waiting time was very important, so they just gave the patient a voucher to the cafe across the road and they left and didn't spend so much time in the clinic. It's a very straightforward idea, but we were quite interested in the idea that the clinic wasn't thought about like a hospital and the experience wasn't like a hospital.
There's another issue, Graham. When you walk into some doctor's surgeries, when you walk into the waiting room, you're immediately confronted by the gaze of other patients. They look up as you come in. And they always seem to have an expression that says, what embarrassing social disease have you come in with? Did you give consideration to simple things such as the way in which chairs should be arranged in waiting rooms?
We did, yes. We thought about those things and lots of other things beside. And we asked students to think about the experience of themselves as a patient, which is obviously an important part if they're going to empathise in that situation. There were some great examples of attempts to make the waiting room a space where you weren't confronted with traffic flows or people at the counter making an appointment and so forth. It also, of course, is quite a tricky question when you're at the same time trying to keep an eye on patients from the medical point of view in case something happens to them. But there are some great examples of it in very straightforward and small clinics. And, of course, there are some terrible ones where you had that experience that you described.
On ABC Radio National, you're listening to By Design, and we're talking about the design of doctors' surgeries and waiting rooms with the architect Graham Crist and a GP, Dr. Hoi Ahn. Dr. Hoi, the manual that you've collaborated on, it places quite a lot of emphasis on safety. For example, it recommends that where possible, a consulting room should have two exits. Why is that?
And obviously, if you look at the clinic, it's very well thought of in many ways. And in the rebirth of the clinic, also look at the safety issue of the staff, of the doctors, and also of other patients. And one of the things that comes out quite interestingly, which is a recommendation from the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners, is the consultation room should have two exits if it's possible. So you just think of it as a fire exit, in case of a very urgent cases. The staff and the doctor can have a exit route, so to speak. But it doesn't have to be two exit, I'm very impressed, in the rebirth of the clinic, the way that the consultation room was arranged so that even with one exit, the aggression, the aggressiveness of whatever, does not actually block the exit of the staff or the doctor. So it can be either two exits or one exit, providing that there is a well-planned ahead escape route for the staff and the doctor, you know, in such a emergency cases.
Graham, you've already mentioned that it's quite common for a doctor's surgery to be located in a house, and this is particularly so perhaps in country towns, and often the only indication that this is a surgery is the traditional red light outside the door. This domesticity, I suppose, is notably absent from bigger modern clinics. Is it a loss, do you think?
Not necessarily. I guess what you've pointed to is two dominant models, really, for small-scale medical clinics. One is, if you like, a small hospital, and some of the super clinics are really quite like that. And then the other model is the house. And there's been a tradition of, in order to deinstitutionalise buildings like clinics, to treat them like a house. We were really looking to the question of whether there were other models and whether there was, in a sense, a third way, so that you do see quite new clinics purpose-built that are designed to look like houses. And we think that really a clinic is a public building and it should have some public and civic presence and function. And so probably a house is not the best model, although some of the qualities of a house, the sense of comfort in a home is what doctors are often aspiring to.
We haven't spoken about what a general practice looks like outside. Graham, you think it's a public building, so what sort of statement do you think the outside of a GP surgery should make?
Well, again, it's really that question of a public presence, and people read buildings, as you were saying, in terms of what they think goes on in there. A house gives a certain message, and a GP clinic, if you like, styled as a house, tells us something. Ian Watts spoke to us from the college about what kind of transaction do you think goes on when you're visiting a doctor, and is it like going to a bank where you're buying something? Is it like going to a house where you're visiting a friend? Is it like going to a hospital where you're being treated? And it's probably none of those, but all of them in a different sense. So there are, if you think about small public buildings in the suburbs like libraries and in a sense like old banks, that might be a clue to how we should think about these buildings. At the same time, of course, there are clinics that are in old houses and make fantastic buildings because they have quite a strong presence as public spaces, I guess.
Well, we'd love to hear from you about your views on doctors' surgeries, what they should look like, whether you should be allowed to be accompanied by friends or any other support group you might have. And you can get in touch with us on our website at abc.net.au/rn/bydesign. If you're a GP and you're thinking about redesigning your surgery or maybe even building a new one from scratch, Rebirth of a Clinic, a design workbook for architecture in general practice and primary care, is a useful tool. Details of that too on our website, and I've been talking to a couple of the people responsible for this new manual, Graham Chris and Dr. Hoi Kwok Ahn. Thank you very much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
On ABC Radio National, you're with The Very Therapeutic by Design. Coming up, the Venice Architecture Biennale.
On Life Matters next week, we take you into the slightly surreal world of doggy daycare.
Milo's a very well-travelled dog. Dad really is bringing Milo here just to try and get Milo to be a little bit more confident and have a little bit more self-esteem. Milo doesn't tend to get amongst things as much as Dad would like.
Be reminded of the human desire to nurture on Life Matters here on ABC Radio National.
Every other year, the Venice Architectural Biennale is an important event on the international architecture calendar. And this year, the challenge is underway to bring the world's best and brightest together. Almost every country sends a representative, and the Australian curators this year, Kirsten Thompson, Neil Durbach, Vince Frost, Gary Warne and Wendy Lewin, are working on their interpretation of this year's theme, which is Out There, Architecture Beyond Building. Well, we'll be talking to them closer to the event. But to tell us about the ideas, we're joined now by historian, writer and critic Aaron Betsky, the director of the 11th Venice Architecture Biennale. He joins us on the phone from Cincinnati, where he's director of the Cincinnati Art Museum. And he's just back from speaking at the influential Design Basel in Europe. It's a busy life, isn't it?
It certainly is. I couldn't have done it before the age of Blackberries.
You're gearing up, as I said, for the 11th Venice International Architecture Biennale. It starts in September, so where are you at the moment?
Where am I at the moment? A little bit frantic because, you know, when you work with architects, it's always late and it's always more complicated than you thought. But it is a lot of fun. I gave myself the challenge that I want to make an architecture biennale without any buildings, and that means that all of the architects that I've invited to make installations and exhibits in Venice have to show me the essence of architecture without proposing actual buildings. And all of the other architects whose work I'm trying to represent, I'm insisting that they not show their proposers for things that are built, but they're more experimental and more sometimes utopian work. And they keep coming to me with buildings, and I keep swatting them down and saying, no, I want you to go beyond buildings. So it takes a little bit of work.
Well, yes, an architecture festival without buildings sounds a bit like a food festival that consists just of plates and knives and forks. So you're suggesting that architecture is not building, it's more than building.
You know, we often get architecture and buildings confused, and they are actually not the same. Buildings are buildings. They are structures that you can live in or work in or play in. And to build something, building is an act. You make something. But how you make a building, how you understand a building, how you figure out a building, how you measure it, how you talk about it, how you think about it, that's what we call architecture. But the irony is that once you make a building, it's hard to find the architecture. Most people just see the walls and the floors and the ceilings and the windows, and architects have to work very hard to make you see architecture. That's why I like to joke that if it leaks, it must be architecture, because the architect is working so hard that it actually leaks. So what I asked was, what is it that is good about architecture, that we want from architecture, that we desire from architecture, and if it's only entombed in buildings, can we get it out?
Well, it's interesting that you should say that if it leaks, it's architecture. I was having a conversation with a group of people in the architecture and design business a couple of days ago, and they were pointing out how a certain distinguished modern architect's buildings do leak. And I say, well, this complaint goes back a long while. It goes back at least as far as James Stirling, the very distinguished British architect whose buildings leaked. Aren't we entitled to say, though, that ideas as strong as James Stirling's or as strong as those of modern architects aren't good enough? We do actually want a building that doesn't leak.
Well, but I think that's where things start. I completely agree with you. I think that architects should be made to take an oath similar to that doctors take, which is first do no harm. And perhaps it should be first make sure it doesn't fall down. First make sure it doesn't leak. But there it only starts. You know, it's the same way that people say, well, architecture these days should be about being environmentally responsible. No, that's not what it should be about. That's where it should start. You cannot afford to have a building that wastes natural resources. So, period, that's what you have to do as an architect. But the problem is you can make a building that doesn't leak and that uses our natural resources wisely and that is boring and oppressive and bland and is still a waste of natural resources. You have to make a building that works, and then you have to make it into architecture. So it only starts there. And as I said, sometimes it's very difficult to make architecture within buildings, and so you might have to make it somewhere else. You might have to make it in your imagination, in movies, or maybe just with a tent.
On ABC Radio National, you're with By Design. I'm Alan Saunders, and I'm talking to Aaron Betsky, the director of the 2008 Venice Architecture Biennale. Aaron, just getting back to this notion of architecture being about ideas and not necessarily buildings. We've been talking a lot on this show lately about the elevation of ideas, the way that ideas have overtaken form, and that function now follows ideas rather than form. Would you go along with that?
Well, I'm afraid I would disagree with you most strongly. I would say that form has overtaken ideas. You know, ideas are very hard to grasp, both intellectually and physically. They just hang out there. What good architecture, and for that matter, good art, or maybe even good music do, or in your example, good food, is to make ideas graspable, make you able to see them, feel them, touch them, smell them, maybe even eat them. And that's what I love about architecture, is that you can get ideas made flesh. Now, to do that, again, you sometimes have to move beyond buildings. And to be even more specific, for strangely enough, for buildings to really communicate or to have ideas that you can understand, they have to be exaggerated so you can understand them. But they also, at times, might have to be so abstract, so strange, that they continually make you wonder, that they continually bring up new ideas.
Well, this does suggest then, does it, that you do need to relish an idea. You shouldn't be afraid of the ideas from which the building might follow, or, I suppose, which the building might provoke.
No, absolutely. But again, I think that one of the things you shouldn't ask buildings to do is to tell you what they are. I think that the strength of buildings is that they can make you sense, in the most simple sense of that word, where you are in relationship to the world around you and to other people. You know, what I'm asking the architects to do is to reveal and appropriate and domesticate those systems, which are mainly of a technological order, that control our daily lives and make us feel as if we have no control over our lives, and do that in such a way that we can feel at home in a modern world that is continually changing and seems out of control. Now, that's a set of, I think, fairly big ideas, and if the architects can pull it off, I think they will have made an architecture worth experiencing there in Venice.
Well, we're back to Venice now. Aaron, as the director for the 2008 Venice Architecture Biennale, how do you decide on your theme, which sets up the whole tone of the Biennale and, as you've already said, challenges the architects?
Well, in one way, it was very, very simple, because when they asked me whether I'd be interested, I said, well, you know, I've made over 100 exhibitions of architecture, and I'm not sure any of them are any good, because you can't really exhibit architecture. You can't put a building in a building. You can make photographs, but that's like showing postcards of the Mona Lisa. You can try to make scale models, but they're like little bitty versions of something you really want to inhabit. Or you can show technical drawings, but no one understands those. So I said, what I really want to do is to have you experience architecture, and that means having to make architecture there, not make buildings, but make architecture. In art, we call it site-specific installation. So it had a very pragmatic reason for moving in that direction, but it's also something I've worked on for many years. You know, I've done a lot of books and a lot of teaching about the fact that architecture is and always has been the built affirmation of the social, political, and economic status quo, and that's because people who have the means are the ones who determine what buildings look like and how they work. So if you want to have an architecture that's critical, that pushes beyond the status quo, then what you have to do is have an architecture that goes beyond building. These days, the borders between architecture and art and technology are all beginning to get fuzzier and fuzzier, and I think architects need to hold on to the strength of their discipline, but they also need to realize that there's an audience out there, there's a wider cultural field in which they operate.
Aaron Betsky, thank you very much for showing us how we patrol these boundaries between architecture and the other arts.
Well, thank you, and I hope I'll see you in Venice.
If only. Aaron is the director of the 2008 Venice Architecture Biennale, which opens in September. Details on our website at abc.net.au/rn/bydesign. As I mentioned earlier, the Australian curators are busy working on their interpretation of Betsky's theme, Out There, Architecture Beyond Building. And one of the members of the team, we've already mentioned, the Sydney graphic designer Vince Frost, talks about his favourite room, today's design aesthetic, and his world of design on a video, By Designs First, yes, we're now in the movie business, which you can access at our website. And here is a bit of that interview, Vince Frost talking books with By Designs' Jan Ryan.
I love books and I love magazines, so I've always collected them. There's very few that I've read from cover to cover, but I just love books as objects and spend lots of times in bookshops around the world and obviously design lots of books and magazines too. I know how much energy and how much work goes into every page and every book and tell a story in a way that whoever's picked the book up will really kind of connect with.
How do you understand today's visual aesthetic? How is it changing?
I think it's obviously influenced by the technology. It's become far more sophisticated than it ever was before. I mean, I've been designing for about 15 years now, and I remember originally doing stuff by hand, and absolutely do think the technology affects the outcome. I think because our work specifically is ideas-driven, it's not aesthetic-driven. What it looks like is not the most important thing, it's what the idea is. And in a way, the aesthetic, or the look of it, evolves out of really getting your head around the problem, to justify every single decision that you make in how you're saying it and what it looks like, etc. There is much more of an international look to things today. It's no longer just an English look or an American look or whatever, Japanese, etc. There is kind of a total mixture of how things are. And in a way, it's become quite Americanized in that respect. I think anything goes today much more than it ever did before. Some years, like last year, you felt there's a lot of illustration going on. This year, it's much more about typography. And you can see that how that's influenced in films or in pop videos or in books and magazines, advertising. It just seems to be something out there that just seems to be this unsaid thing, like color. How color is one year, color, everything's bright yellow. And that kind of, I don't know if it starts with fashion or whether it's just something that there's an energy that people are picking up on.
Well, if you want to find out about the colours of the new By Design video, check it out on our website at abc.net.au/rn/bydesign. That was Vince Frost, a member of the Australian curatorial team, whose work will be on display in the Australian Pavilion at the 11th Venice Architecture Biennale. Now, time for Your Say, and this week, two responses to our recent story on the interior design of trains. Chester Graham comments, "Your interviewee mentioned the trains to Newcastle. Has he ever looked inside them?" Chester then goes on to list a number of issues, including wire double-decker trains which take so long to fill and empty, running on a line with 33 stops. And some cars have hooks for bicycles, some have racks for luggage. There is no way of knowing where these cars are unless you chance on one. So bikes clog the lobbies and luggage takes up seats. And Judith Watson from West Australia writes, "As a former state MP, I organise consultations with children aged 10 and 11 from 5 schools in the electorate to try to establish what they thought government could do for them. One consistent wish was for better train cabin design. As they said, we have to stand for grown-ups but can't reach the straps to hang on to, and there are very few seat holders when seats are mainly along the sides. Train travel for primary school-aged children in particular remains a challenge yet to be addressed. And if you want to get on board the comment train, the place to go is that website. I've already mentioned it, abc.net.au/rn/bydesign. Coming up next, trends and products. Trends and Products is the part of the show where each week we look at what's happening in a very particular part of the designed world. This week we're opening the doors, or I should have hoped having the doors opened for us, on hotel lobbies. Well, my favourite lobby experience occurred at a favourite hotel of mine, the Paramount in New York. It used to be a very happening place, gothically dark, designed by Philippe Starck with a Mark Newsom Lockheed lounge. So there I was checking in when I heard behind me a rustle of cycling or hiking wear and heard an out-of-towner say to another out-of-towner, "Well, I guess everywhere looks weird if you've not been there before." A useful reminder, perhaps, that though it might be the quality of the room you'll remember longest after you check out, it's the lobby which creates that all-important first impression, and in this particular case, possibly a somewhat alienating first impression. My next guest, Jeffrey Lee, is managing principal of the international architecture firm Woodhead, which has designed hotels around the world. Jeffrey Lee, welcome to By Design.
Thank you, Alan.
At the top end, the hotel industry is extremely competitive. So are owners looking to you to create lobbies with that wow factor, a space that will make guests feel very important the moment they walk through the door?
Certainly that's a major important item, is to give the hotel a unique character from the moment that the guest actually approaches the hotel, not only when the doors are opened for them, but that can vary from being grand lobbies to being very intimate and artistic spaces. So it really depends on what the client and the context of the hotel is trying to achieve.
So size doesn't necessarily matter?
No, size doesn't necessarily matter, because I've been in some very grand lobbies, as you would understand, but also I've been in some very intimate and very artistic ones, and boutique hotels can often be very interesting, albeit they're not particularly grand or large lobbies.
Unlike bedroom suites or bar areas, lobbies actually don't make money for the owners, do they? So I guess there must be a limit on how big they can be or how much money you want to spend on them.
Yes, they can be quite large spaces, and initially when they are built in hotels probably 20, 30 years ago, often had grand lobbies that didn't necessarily make money. But one of the new trends over the last probably 5 to 10 years is, how do you make some money out of a lobby? And certainly when we did the Four Seasons Hotel here in Sydney for the Olympics, one of the drivers there was to take the seats which everybody sat in and met to actually move them to more a cafe where they could actually make some money out of the lobby.
Well, this brings us to a recent edition of Vanity Fair, which had a story about a collaboration between the designer Karl Lagerfeld and the star architect Zaha Hadid. And it mentioned how they conducted their business meeting in the foyer of the Mercer Hotel in New York. Now, that's a reminder, isn't it, that as well as being places to check in and check out, hotel lobbies today are often expected to provide, as it were, neutral spaces in which people can conduct business.
Yes, that's absolutely right. You'll see that lobbies do have a function, but of checking in and so forth, but one of the other functions is a meeting place, both for business people, and you actually see in places like Hong Kong and Singapore and so forth in Asia, you see a lot of people conducting meetings over cups of coffee, and they are also social spaces. So after business is finished, they become the bar, the lobby, the hip and happening place where people and business people basically start to have a bit of a social interaction.
How do you, can you give some examples of how you facilitate that variety of uses?
Well, it often depends on the type of hotel. An example that comes to mind is the Intercontinental in Hong Kong, which used to be the old Regent, which has a fantastic view overlooking the Hong Kong harbour. And so a lot of people go there for pleasure, but also for business, and will sit down and have a cup of coffee. I was actually in the Perth yesterday at the Ridges Hotel, which we did, and that basically has quite a small lobby, but has quite a sort of a trendy bar and restaurant that basically all flow and integrate into that space.
Are international hotel lobbies, especially perhaps in Asia, places like China and India, are they designed to provide a safe haven, a sort of buffer zone between the reality of a foreign place, and if you're coming from the English-speaking world, it might be a very foreign place for you, and the sanctuary of the bedroom suite? Is it a sort of cultural buffer zone?
I don't think you necessarily set out to achieve that, but what often happens is that's what it is. And I can remember many times when I first went to Beijing to do business, is that the Grand Hyatt Hotel in Beijing, which is about 500 metres from Tiananmen Square, it was full of international people doing business over a coffee table, and I had many a design presentation over a coffee table and a cup of coffee with clients. And because for us it was a familiar place, that was probably the place where they would speak English the most in Beijing, that was a very sort of comfortable environment. And in India, when you go there, because of sometimes the food aspects, you like to stay at a place that you can trust, that you're not going to get sick. And that's a huge factor when you're travelling, both, you know, as a businessman but also as a tourist.
Absolutely, yes. I think you've noted that Australian design is often considered too simple, too minimalist and plain for other tastes around the world, particularly, in fact, our neighbours in Asia and also in the Middle East. Is that so?
Well, Australia hasn't got a long history necessarily of its own in architecture, and the more modern design is quite contemporary and a bit minimalist. And that's got to do with our construction costs and labour here and materials. But in Asia, they do have long histories, and in India, they do have a lot of culture. And they often feel that they want more, and they want to be more ornate, because a lot of those cultural things are quite ornate compared to what we in Australia are used to. So they feel as if they need to have more things in the space to make it, to fill it up.
Well, this brings us to the question of how lobby design needs to be sensitive to local culture. There were some rather unusual demands on the design of the hotel at the Oberoi Hotel in the Indian city of Chandigarh, weren't there?
Yes, it was one of those more amusing aspects that you come across as an architect, and that was we designed this hotel, a six-star hotel in Chandigarh, just north of New Delhi, and quite often the ballrooms in a Western hotel they'll often be on the sort of the first floor, the one up from the ground, and so we designed this 1,000 sort of seat ballroom, and obviously India and China have lots of people, so they need fairly big spaces, so they could be over 1,000. And then they said to us, well, you can't have it on there. How do you get the elephants into the ballroom? And we went, what elephants? And of course, what we didn't realise was that they, in the first instance, was that weddings and ceremonies, the bride and groom will actually arrive at the wedding ceremony on top of an elephant. So you have to be able to take the weight of the elephant, and have enough height in the space so that the poor old bride doesn't get knocked off.
Okay, well, that's something. I want to get married on an elephant now, I've decided.
Oh, no, I think it sounds very romantic.
Yes, yes. But Geoffrey Lee, it's time to check out. Thanks very much for staying with By Design.
Oh, it was a pleasure staying here.
Geoffrey Lee is managing principal of the Australian-based architecture firm Woodhead. Coming up soon, innovation. First, though, some hotel lobby music. Well, actually, no, it's something that makes for very bad lobby music. But I once heard it in a hotel lobby, and it was a curiously unsettling experience. Quite put me off my whiskey and soda. It's The Last Waltz from A Little Night Music by Stephen Sondheim. Well, I'm all on edge now. I don't know about you. In the last couple of weeks, the engineer Tristram Carfrae has been travelling around Australia delivering the 2008 Innovation Lectures for the Warren Centre for Advanced Engineering, which is based at the University of Sydney. In his lecture, he's been talking about why innovation is a difficult concept in the world of building design, how each party in the process of design, from client through to subcontractor, will have a different view of the risks and benefits of innovation. Most are risk-averse, he observes, and this stops a lot of innovations from ever getting off the ground. Well, Tristram Carfrae is in our Sydney studio today, and all will be revealed. Tristram, hello.
Thank you. Thank you, Alan.
Now, risk is a four-letter word, and we don't like it. You mentioned that your profession, structural engineering, is maybe one of the most risk-averse. Now, I can think of good reasons for that. Something I've already alluded to on this show. I want a building that doesn't leak, and I want it to stand up. So that's a good reason for not being too risky. But why is it the most risk-averse profession? Why isn't it at the cutting edge of the new building revolution in terms of shapes and materials?
Well, unfortunately, probably two main reasons why structural engineering is slightly risk-averse or not innovative. The first is that our basic fundamentals haven't changed. We're still using materials, you know, the most recent material to arrive on the building's sort of scene, if you like, was concrete or reinforced concrete in the 20s. And also the things that we design buildings to resist, the loads, gravity, snow, wind, also haven't changed, although maybe with climate change they will be subtly shifting over the next 50 or so years. So that's one thing. The other one is that, of course, the consequence of failure is awful. You know, as you said, buildings falling down, it's totally unacceptable.
You raise an important point at the beginning of your lecture, which is possibly the key to everything you were saying, which is that to encourage innovation and creativity, you must be prepared to tolerate failure. You've just been talking about extreme failures, but what sort of failure can you be prepared to tolerate?
Well, effectively, the sort of failure during design of a structural engineer has to be something that is found and met and dealt with during the design process, because each building is in essence a prototype. It is the first of its kind, so the failure cannot occur at the prototype stage, but has to be pre-prototype.
Well, that's interesting because it reminds us of something that very few of us, I think, realise, which is that a building is a prototype. Engineering is not predictive, but that much is based on judgment.
Absolutely. I think society at large feels that engineers work in a numerate, if you like, or calculable world, and we should be able to predict everything with absolute certainty. But actually, it's far from the case. And a lot of judgment goes into engineering. In fact, what we choose to analyse and the way we analyse it is far more important to the end result than the actual analysis itself, for example.
Well, judgment is based on experience. So over time, don't engineers, and for that matter society at large, don't they have trust and have to have trust in human judgment and experience?
In this case, I think society has a high degree of trust, at least I hope they do, in engineers to get things right, which is born out of experience that fortunately there haven't been many instances of engineers getting things wrong. But at the same time, I don't think society at large has any deep understanding of the methods by which engineers have developed that trust.
Looking at the engineers themselves, what do you need if you're going to be innovative? What personal elements encourage an engineer to be an innovative sort of person?
A wonderful Spanish female designer, artist, if you like, told me once that there are three things required for an individual to innovate. And the first one is fairly fundamental. They have to want to. Very obvious, if you like. But actually, if you think about it, it's a pretty powerful statement. The second is that they need an independent spirit, perhaps a slightly poetic view of life, but yes, they have to be able to do things on their own. And lastly, and most importantly, a very high degree of self-confidence. After all, you have to believe that your innovation, your new way of doing something, is better than everything that everybody else has ever done before.
Do you think you have those qualities?
Ah. Who knows, Alan?
This is By Design on ABC Radio National. I'm Alan Saunders, and this morning I'm with the engineer, Tristram Carfrae, who's talking about self-confidence and innovation. He's just finished delivering the 2008 Innovation Lecture for the Warren Centre at the University of Sydney. Tristram, we haven't quite made it clear what constitutes innovation in engineering as opposed to architecture. But so let's look, perhaps approach that through a couple of people in your life who've taught you about the edge, about going into the undefined area where no one's gone before, engineeringly speaking. Ove Arup and Peter Rice. Let's start with Ove Arup, whose firm is famous for its, in this country, for its work on the Sydney Opera House. What made him an innovator, and what did you learn from him?
Ove was a wonderful and interesting man. He was firstly educated and, if you like, brought up in what was then termed continental Europe, in a liberal arts background, and studied philosophy before studying engineering. And so one of the primary things he taught me is, in the end, it's all about humanity. It's all about people's experiences. And even though engineering might seem a dry sort of technical topic, it is absolutely pointless unless we're trying to improve the world.
And for him, innovation was what?
When he started Arup as a company, his aim was to try and get the parties, which at those times didn't talk to each other, to collaborate. So he said architects designed something, engineers worked out what size it should be, and builders built the outcome. And wouldn't it be much better, particularly with the advent of concrete, a sort of plastic fluid material, if those three parties actually talked to one another at the beginning?
Right. So for him, innovation was a question not of what he was doing on with his calculations. It was a question of the relationship between him and the architect, or him and the architect and the client, and so on.
Yes, it was an innovation, if you like, in an approach. And the approach was partly the method, which I've just described, but secondly, what you're trying to achieve. He set up the firm with ambitions to do with, you know, there must be a way of enjoying coming to work as opposed to working simply for money. And if we enjoyed it, hopefully money would be a consequence.
Let's look at the other person I mentioned, the Irishman, Peter Rice. He was famous in engineering and building circles, but perhaps not very well known to the general public. He's famous for saying it is safer to innovate. Now, what does that mean? Sounds frightening.
Well, maybe frightening. He was trying to do the opposite, of course. He persuaded his clients that it generally was safer to innovate, because if we did the same thing day in and day out, we would become sloppy and careless and make mistakes. Whereas if we tried to do something new, we had no choice, if you like, but to analyse everything, to critically assess every consequence of what we were doing, and therefore, in the end, it would be safer. I think he was mainly just trying to respond to most people's belief that innovation is inherently risky, and say that is not actually the case. It is neither more risky nor less risky than what we do already.
Could you give us an example or two of innovation that he was responsible for in building?
Peter worked actually a lot on the geometry of the Opera House. He was here in Sydney for 3 years, but later, more famously perhaps, the Centre Pompidou in Paris and Lloyd's of London in London, of course.
Yes.
And in both of them, it was to do with engineering on display, a building that could be, if you like, visually interrogated. You could understand what the components did, but also the components were made in new ways. So we had cast gerberettes on the Pompidou Centre, for example.
Well, in both those buildings, the Pompidou Centre and Lloyd's of London, you've got, as you say, the engineering on display. But I think most of us, in seeing that, would say, "Ah, yes, this is a brilliant lyrical gesture on the part of the architect." And obviously, yes, he must have had an engineer getting the details sorted out. But what we most notice, which is the engineering on display, we tend to attribute not to the engineer, but to the architect.
Yes, and for the last century, I suggest, particularly the latter half, you know, architects have been allowed to and have claimed to be the sole authors of a work of architecture. And indeed, engineers call themselves consulting engineers. They were asked for advice, and that's all they did was proffer advice. But I'd suggest to you that this century, in particular, there's far more intimate collaboration between engineers and architects, and the result are buildings which come from that intimate collaboration. And in fact, I would suggest to you that the Opera House, Centre Pompidou and Lloyd's of London in particular could not have existed, could not have manifested themselves without that intimate collaboration between engineer and architect.
You've pointed out that the stresses and strains to which buildings are liable, you know, they're not changing, even though some of the climatic things might be getting worse. But what about other changes? What about the fact that we now live in a digital world with a lot of software, a lot of sophisticating modelling? Do you have to keep up with that?
It's not so much to keep up with that, Alan, but the next 20 years, I think, are going to be a real revolution for engineers because, as I said earlier, each building is a prototype and we don't get the opportunity to test full-scale buildings. But the virtual world that we can now inhabit, we get the opportunity to explore all sorts of options and opportunities in the digital world before building the real thing. I think in our struggle, if you like, to benefit humanity over the next 50 years while consuming no more than the planet can provide, this virtual world is going to be our saviour. But engineers will have to change a bit. They will have to become far more experimental, judgmental, communicative and collaborative and explore this virtual world in a much more trusting fashion than they're used to actually just adding up two and two and getting four.
And presumably, with any luck, get your signature at the bottom of the building alongside the architects.
Ultimately, yes. And some people feel that engineers are becoming pushy and wishing to displace architects. And I don't take that view at all. But I do think that working together as a team right from the outset, much as I've originally postulated, we can get better results.
Tristram Carfrae, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you, Alan.
Tristram is an Arup Fellow and the Warren Centre's 2008 Innovation Lecturer. Details on our website at abc.net.au/rn/bydesign. That's also the place to go for details of our podcasts or to write to us about anything you've heard on the show or anything else that's on your mind. And it's also the place to go to check out the first By Design video in which we visit the studio of Vince Frost. The show is produced by Mark Wakeley and Jan Ryan, with technical production this week by Anne-Marie de Bettencourt. I'm Alan Saunders, and I'll be back next week with another By Design.
ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.